From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Overweight women over age 70 increase their risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, according to a new study out today. The news is the latest in what has been a steady diet of stories about the perils and politics of fat in recent weeks. The Food and Drug Administration announced it will require food companies to spotlight artery-clogging trans fatty acids on nutrition labels by 2006. Industry giant Kraft Foods said it will cut the sugar, fat, and portion sizes of some foods. And some supersized lawsuits may be in the wings. Tonight, On Point, all about fat, America's love-hate national obsession. But first, we begin with the latest in the case against accused 9/11 conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui. The U.S. Justice Department has refused to make terror witness Ramzi bin al-Shib available for questioning by Moussaoui, who is serving as his own lawyer. In response, the federal judge hearing his case could dismiss charges against the so-called 20th hijacker, in effect sending the case to a military tribunal. Robert Precht is Assistant Dean of Public Service at the University of Michigan Law School and was defense attorney to the lead defendant in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. I asked him why the Justice Department is refusing to produce the witness, Ramzi bin al-Shib.
You have to understand the background. There's a power struggle between the lawyers in the Justice Department and the soldiers in the Pentagon. The lawyers in the Justice Department want to keep terrorism cases in the civil trial system. They believe in the Constitution. They believe in the Bill of Rights. On the other side, however, the Pentagon views terrorism as a military problem, and they want to deal with accused terrorists by means of the military commissions or tribunals.
So how does this figure into the Zacharias Moussaoui case?
Well, because Ashcroft feels that he has to walk this tightrope. On the one hand, he wants to keep it in the civil trial system, and yet he has to prove to the soldiers in the Pentagon that these cases can be tried in our civil system without hurting the Pentagon's investigation of al-Qaeda.
So let's play that out a little bit. The so-called 20th hijacker,
right,
Moussaoui, says, I want to talk to bin al-Shib as a part of preparation for my case. And the judge says, yes, he should be able to. Justice says no. What's going on?
Well, Justice is basically defying the district court. The district court has ordered Justice to produce this witness. Justice is saying no, and so the next step is what kinds of sanctions will the district court impose on the government? If the district court imposes an extreme sanction, such as dismissing the case, the case will inevitably end up in a military tribunal. However, the district court has less severe sanctions it could impose. For example, the district court could give an instruction to the jury that the government failed to produce this witness, and the jury can therefore conclude this witness would have testified favorably to the defense. By imposing that sanction, the court could still basically penalize the government, but not so severely as to prompt the government to move this into the military tribunal.
Moussaoui is representing himself, but he is assisted by attorneys. Is it a reasonable request, given the charges against him, that he asked to talk with bin al-Shib? Is this standard kind of procedure?
It's absolutely standard procedure. Basically, although Mr. Moussaoui has been turning the trial into a circus atmosphere on occasion, his request to interview bin al-Shib is a standard request that would be granted to any trial defendant in our civil system. The problem is, however, that the government believes this witness is so important to keep interrogating that Moussaoui's request conflicts with national security. And at the same time, you have the lawyers. I have a feeling that the lawyers are saying, Mr. Moussaoui, you should stand firm on this request. But of course, if he does, and if the lawyers are unwilling to compromise, that's precisely the scenario in which the district court might dismiss the case and it would end up in the military tribunal, which would be very hurtful to Moussaoui because it would be much harder for him to receive an impartial hearing. So what the lawyers on both sides really need to do is that they have to compromise. And the lawyers so far, both on the government side and the defense lawyers, have shown an unwillingness to compromise. They've stuck to their extreme positions. And I think that in the interest of keeping these cases, not only this case, but future cases in our civilian court system, the lawyers have to put their heads together and say, okay, We accept that the government's not going to produce this witness, but let us fashion together remedies that will at least in part level the playing field for Mr. Massawi.
What is at stake here then for civil justice if there's this trapdoor that Massawi can fall through and he finds himself suddenly in the military justice system? Are there broader implications for defendants in trials other than this one?
Well, absolutely. This is a huge case not only for Mr. Massawi, but for future accused terrorists, because if the parties in this case, if the lawyers for the Justice Department cannot show others in the Bush administration that it can keep government secrets, then in the future all of these cases will end up in military tribunals. So the government attorneys in the Justice Department are walking a tightrope. On the one hand, they believe in the Constitution and they want to provide basic protections. On the other hand, they also know they have to convince skeptics in the Bush administration that don't want these cases to be in civilian settings to start with.
But who's to say that this could, would, or should go to a military tribunal if it doesn't work out in the civil courts? The military doesn't have the authority to demand that, do they?
President Bush does. He has given himself the authority through an executive order by which he can designate any person who is a non-U.S. citizen to stand trial on terrorism charges before a military commission. It is solely his decision. It is non-reviewable. And, of course, the people in the Pentagon have to follow his marching orders.
Is there any doubt in your mind that it's reasonable that the government is not willing to produce Mr. bin al-Shib, who, of course, is held in an undisclosed location? They say that if he did talk with Massawi, national security would be compromised. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Well, yes. Actually, you know, as a defense lawyer, I'm trained to be skeptical of government claims. But frankly, I do think the government's position is reasonable. This is an individual not in U.S. territory. He's being held by the military and being subjected to intensive interrogation. And I think there's some persuasiveness to the government's argument that we have to keep this person incommunicado because he is much more important in terms of revealing and disclosing his contacts and possible future terrorist attacks than being a witness for Massawi in a civil courtroom.
And ultimately, Robert Precht, what do you see as the implications for American justice if terrorist trials simply go off the rails of civilian justice and into the military realm? What does it mean overall for American justice?
Well, I think it would be a very sad day for American justice if Mr. Massawi's case and future cases go into military commissions. Not only do I say that as an American who believes in the Constitution, but remember, one of the biggest goals of our justice system is sending a message not only to our own people, but to the rest of the world, that people found guilty have been given a fair and impartial trial. And the civil system contains safeguards, and it sends a powerful message when there is a conviction that the person received a fair trial. Unfortunately, military commissions, by their very nature, lack safeguards, and there are so many loopholes in the military commission process that basically the order says that the U.S. Constitution is suspended. And when you have a verdict of guilty that comes out of a military commission, that is not going to command world respect. And I think we're going to lose a great opportunity to prove to the world that we can be fair.
Could easily be portrayed as a kangaroo court proceeding.
Absolutely.
Robert Precht, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Precht is Assistant Dean of Public Service at the University of Michigan Law School and is author of the forthcoming book, Defending Muhammad, Justice on Trial, the Defense Attorney's Account of the 1993 World Trade Center Bombing Trial. He spoke with me from Ann Arbor, Michigan. America's waistline is getting steadily bigger, a whole lot bigger. Heart disease and obesity now cost society some $300 billion and countless lives each year. But American food companies are still churning out mountains of fatty food. And American consumers are still buying and eating that fat with gusto. The lure of the Big Mac, nachos topped with Velveeta, and that stack of Oreos is just too much for many to resist. Tonight, we look at the trouble with trans fats, the fear of new lawsuits, and the fate of fat in the American diet. Whose fault is this fat state of affairs? Food producers or consumers? Who should be held accountable? Do you know the difference between trans fat, saturated fat, and just too much fat? Do you read food labels? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Dr. Walter Willett, chair of the Nutrition Department at the Harvard School of Public Health and an expert on trans fats. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Walter Willett.
Good evening.
Thanks very much for being with us. A great hubbub about fats in recent weeks of all kinds, and in particular in the last week on trans fats. Out of all the reams of headlines and news out there in the last week, Walter Willett, what do you think is most important for consumers to understand about trans fats, trans fatty acids in their foods and diet?
Well, the main point is that trans fats are the worst type of fat in the diet. And until now, and in fact, it's not entirely possible yet, but the problem is that consumers haven't been able to know how much trans fat was in the products that they were buying because it was not on the food label. In fact, many people have thought they were buying a healthier product, but ended up buying something that was unhealthy, in fact, maybe even worse than the alternatives because it was high in trans fat.
What kind of foods on a typical supermarket shelf would be trans fat heavy?
Well, almost all foods that are made by commercial baking process, cookies, crackers, cakes, are high in trans fat. Most margarines are, but there are now a good number of margarines that are free of trans fatty acids, fortunately. And in the fast food business, almost anything that's deep fried should be assumed to contain high amounts of trans fat.
And why are these more unhealthful than saturated fats, which we've heard about ever since the food labels showed up in 1993?
Well, trans fats raise LDL, the bad cholesterol, almost to the same degree as do saturated fats. But unlike any other type of fat, trans fat depresses HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol, and it has other bad metabolic effects as well. So when we put all this together, we see that trans fats are substantially more strongly related to risk of heart disease than our saturated fats. And if that's not bad enough, there's quite a bit of evidence now that trans fats increase risk of type 2 diabetes, even after controlling for body weight and physical activity.
So heart disease and diabetes sitting there. Walter Willett, as you watch the whole hubbub over fat going on these days, you know, there's the new food labels coming out. The big food manufacturers are saying they're going to cut back. There's the threat of lawsuits. What do you make of all this? Are we headed toward a more healthful American diet here, or is this all political and legalistic posturing?
No, I think there are some real changes that are going to be occurring. In fact, with the trans fat on the food label, probably the most important change will be not that people are going to be looking and figuring out which foods to buy and not to buy, but now there's a big incentive for the food industry to take trans fats out of their products, and that's why a lot of them are scrambling at the moment. So I think the real big change will be that these will hopefully almost disappear from the food supply. And, of course, that's the best solution of all.
Can they really do that without changing the American food supply as we've known it? Glazed donuts, Oreos, you know, nachos topped with cheese and all the rest. Does that all depend on trans fats for mouthfeel and that yummy deep-fried feeling that Americans seem to love so much?
No, it actually is very possible to take trans fat out of the food supply. For example, Bread and Circus here in Boston.
A kind of a Whole Foods food chain.
They've never allowed trans fats into their food products. And if you shop there, you realize you can get everything, and it's really the best quality food you can purchase. In Europe, they've been very aggressive during the last 10 years taking trans fats out of their products. And in Holland, for example, trans fats went from about 6% of calories to 1% of calories over a 10-year period. So large changes are possible. It takes a little creativity, and most of all, it takes some commitment to make healthier products.
And a little willpower on the part of consumers. Dr. Walter Willett, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, it was a pleasure to be with you.
Walter Willett is chair of the Nutrition Department at Harvard School of Public Health. Listeners, we are talking tonight about fat in the public fire, trans fat, fat suits, fat in the label, fat in the Oreos. We're looking at America's obsession with fat. Whose fault is all this fat? The food producers or the food consumers? You who should be accountable for what Americans eat. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about fat in the public fire, about trans fats and fat suits and fat in the labels, America's obsession with fats. You can join the conversation. Do you know the difference between trans fat, saturated fat, and just plain too much fat? Do you read food labels? Can you figure them out? And does reading them keep you thin? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now from Chicago by Colleen Zammer. She's a food scientist with a company called TX. It's a firm that advises food companies on technology and food production. Good evening and welcome, Colleen Zammer.
Good evening.
And from Wellesley, Massachusetts, I'm joined by Ross Petty, professor of marketing law at Babson College's Olin Graduate School of Management. Good evening and welcome, Ross Petty.
Hello, thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Ross Petty, let me turn first to you. Lots of pressure on food manufacturers from any number of directions these days to make their foods healthier. The pressure of food labeling that will now lay out trans fats in the food Americans eat, or soon will. The pressure of lawsuits with fatty foods threatening to become the new tobacco. How do you see big American food manufacturers responding to these threats?
Well, I think there's a range of response. I think a lot of food manufacturers are trying their best to cope with the changing situation and will make changes to their product. I think we've also seen some food manufacturers trying to make fun of the big fat lawsuits and deny there's a problem.
So, but at bottom, there's a characterization that has been emerging, or people have been trying to get into the public mind in the last year or two, of food manufacturers as real bad guys, as kind of deliberately, you know, evil purveyors of the food that kills Americans. Is that fair, Ross Petty? They do know what's in that food.
They know what's in it. They don't necessarily know before the nutrition community how good or bad trans fats and other ingredients might be. I think it's also true that the food industry is driven a lot by cost. And so if they can find a lower cost way of making a product taste good, then they'll use that unless there's reason not to.
So, Colleen Zammer, are the alarm bells ringing in the food companies that you talk with? There's a lot of action among lawyers who have pulled down some pretty big settlements on the tobacco front, and they're looking very hard at fat right now. A lot of suits in preparation. Is it shaking up the American food processing industry?
It's shaking up the food industry, but more so from the standpoint of I think the labeling is probably more of a threat to them than the lawsuits. You know, lawsuits can happen. They probably will happen, but I don't think the food companies are as concerned about that as they are of what the consumer is going to think when they take a look at labels and have the option of comparing now trans fats and total fats between one product versus another.
So how hard is it for the food manufacturers, Colleen Zammer? They would love to get trans fats out of these foods before the labels hit the shelves in 2006. The FDA has given them a nice long runway, at least from a consumer perspective. That seems a long time off. But we already read, McDonald's said last fall that it would take trans fats out of its French fries. It has so far been unable to do that. It says they just don't taste right without them. Kraft Foods announcing a big initiative to make its foods healthier, but saying it's having a real hard time dealing with the yummy stuff inside an Oreo. Is it possible to get the trans fats out and still have the kind of food that Americans are hooked on, whether that's a good thing or not?
It is possible, but it is a major challenge. I mean, Dr. Willett did speak to the fact that there are products available that are trans-free, but the products that are already out there are very specifically formulated and formulated to our taste buds. And we've been eating Oreos and Doritos for a long time. We know exactly what they taste like, and we really like that, so that's why we keep going back to it. Now we want to take these things out, and yes, 2006 is a long time away, but the food manufacturers have actually known about this for at least 3 years now.
Mm-hmm.
So they've been working on it. The suppliers of fats and oils have been working very hard to come up with alternative substitutes that are trans-free, but there is a cost associated with it. So I think the food companies are trying to balance all those things, make sure they get the right product out there so that they don't turn off their consumers but also make sure that their consumers don't have to pay three times as much for the product.
And is this a real effort, or is this all marketing, these announcements that we read? I mean, Kraft is talking about reducing its portion sizes, but I suppose you could just eat twice as many. I mean, isn't it a change in the fundamental food itself that's required to help Americans get on a healthier diet?
There should be a change in the foods and also in the portion sizes, because it's been proven that the larger portion you're provided with, the more food you're going to eat. So if you buy the big grab of potato chips, it's likely you'll finish the whole bag, as opposed to, or if you buy a small bag, you'll probably finish that bag as well and be equally as satisfied. So there is something to be said about portion sizes, but changing the nutritional profile of these products would be helpful as well, and educating consumers so that they understand what it is they're eating when they're buying these products.
It's just an amazing portion of the foods on the shelves of a typical American supermarket that are bursting with trans fats. It seems like an awful big revolution. I want to invite our callers in. We're talking tonight about fat in the public fire this week, this month. Will America's big food makers ever produce truly healthy foods? And should they be forced to? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Phil is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi, I just had a quick comment. I recently graduated from Harvard Business School.
Okay.
And I had a comment on the marketing angle on this and the responsibility that marketers need to take, and almost a marketing ethics issue.
How do you see it?
I see it very much similar to the accounting scandals that have been going on. Since then, in business school, we've learned a lot about marketing, a lot about accounting and ethics in accounting.
There are a lot of ways to portray what the company's doing.
A lot of ways to portray that. But on the marketing side, it seems like we really need to teach an ethics element here. And when should a company stop marketing their products? When should they not market bigger portion sizes? When should they not market supersizing it?
Mm-hmm. It's a huge issue. Let me put it to Ross Petty and hang on, Phil. Ross, companies, of course, want to market and they want to sell. But the fundamental problem seems here at some level to be that maybe the best food is the least processed food, but these companies make their money by processing and packaging foods. What do you see as not just the law, but the ethics of marketing? Is it ethical to market something that's going to clog someone's heart and kill them?
Well, and it's a question of how much, since I don't think it's true for trans fats, but even for saturated fats, our bodies do need some of those in order to grow and thrive.
Well, fair enough, but hardly in proportion to the amount of marketing that most Americans and American children face day in and day out to encourage them to buy and eat these products.
I think that's true, and I think there are some very specific children's marketing issues as well as general marketing issues. It's generally okay for a marketer to supersize, you know, a box of nails, but then if you supersize a fatty meal, that leads to even greater health consequences.
But is there even an awareness of such a thing as marketing ethics in the food business? As far as you know, I mean, supersizing is everywhere these days in the United States. Is this even part of the vocabulary of the food manufacturer?
Well, I think they are aware of ethics. There's certainly been enough academic things floating around in marketing ethics, although relatively little that I've seen focused specifically on food. And so for them, we may need a crash course in food-specific ethical concerns.
So, and Colleen Zammer, how do you see it? Do you feel, in the food companies that you work with, an ethical sense about what they're pumping out for Americans to eat? Or is it all about profit margins? They're public companies, and they're followed on the stock charts.
Well, it is a lot about profit margins, and it's a lot about making the consumers happy, which, at the end of the day, the companies make money for doing that. And so right now, consumers have not been clamoring for healthier foods. And so companies are giving those consumers what they want, which is more value for their money, good-tasting products. And until consumers start asking for healthier products, it's unlikely that food companies are going to start forcing these things upon them. You know, it's just not the way the food business is done. So
if you eat it, they'll sell it to you, it sounds like.
Well, unfortunately.
That sounds like the way it is. Colleen Zammer, Ross Petty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Palo Alto, California, Dr. Christopher Gardner. He's director of Stanford University's Center for Research in Disease Prevention. Good evening and welcome, Christopher Gardner.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. You've no doubt been watching the whole clamor around fat in recent days and weeks here, trans fats and all the rest. When you look at the big picture here, Christopher Gardner, you know the debate is about where accountability lies at some level. Should fatty foods become the new sort of tobacco-style target of lawsuits in the United States? Who's responsible to help change the American diet? Where do you see the bulk of responsibility falling?
Okay, tough question. It's going to have to be shared by all. Certainly this comes down to individual choice, and people are going to demand the foods they want. But it's not entirely up to them if the choices out there are limited. And I would pick school children, for one, going into school. They get what's in the school, and they can't get other things. So if we've offered them good choices, they'll pick their favorite among those choices.
Mm.
If we offer them lousy choices, they'll pick their best among those lousy choices.
Is that so different from a supermarket shelves? I mean, you must walk down them yourselves. In many supermarkets, there's an awful lot that would fall in an unhealthful category.
Well, that's true, sure. So, yes, some guidelines would work there. And smoking, it didn't work until we got some legislation around it. I don't feel too comfortable giving a lot of my perspective in that regard since I'm a health scientist. I focus on the health, not so much on the marketing and the legal issues. But I do have a 9 and a 12-year-old. And I am frustrated myself at some choices that I don't have when I go certain places. In fact, in California, I very much enjoy all the health food stores and farmers markets that I'm surrounded by. And I notice it when I go other places that I don't have those same choices.
And what about on the health front itself? A lot of attention to trans fatty acids in the last week. Do you welcome this? Is this appropriate? Or is this another sort of bout of headlines that take us off in a direction we'll be whipped somewhere else next week?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm a little concerned that it's a bout of headlines. It's going to get the public frustrated with health professionals.
Why is that? It's, so far, it sounds as though the public's going to get more information, help them make better choices.
They are, but in one regard, we keep pinning health on individual targets instead of patterns. And in this case, we're pinning it on trans fatty acids, when in fact, probably the much bigger picture is the type of foods that the trans fatty acids are in. So let me give you a potential scenario where somebody's eating a lousy diet all day long, and then they go to the supermarket shelf, and they have one set of cookies they could buy that has trans and one cookie product that doesn't have trans fatty acids.
Mm-hmm.
How good should they feel that they picked the cookies without the trans fatty acids? They ate lousy all day. They're having cookies at the end of the day. To be honest, I don't really think that made very much difference.
So it's in a way of building a rationale for one more helping of something that's not that healthy anyway.
Yeah. I mean, the place the trans fats appear, well, they do appear naturally in some meats and some vegetables by bacterial production.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very small amounts. But actually, the amount of trans fats in the U.S. diet is really pretty low. It's only 1% or 2% of calories. And if I wanted to put all my effort into making a major change in the U.S. diet, it wouldn't be so much getting the trans fat from 2% to 1%.
Where would it be if you were the American food industry or one American consumer?
If I got to be the food czar,
yes,
I would say somehow in the food in the schools and the supermarkets we need to have less processed food, minimally processed, lots more root vegetables and beans and grains and things prepared attractively, not just raw veggies, which people can only do for so long.
Right.
We need to have Indian and Middle Eastern and Latin American meals that are spicy and aromatic and flavorful. And all these countries made meals that were plant-based. Whether it was for economic reasons or agricultural or religious reasons, they were plant-based.
Well, that sounds terrific, and it sounds like something we could live a lot longer with. But Colleen Zammer, are the economics of the food industry such that they could shift over a decade to the kind of store shelves that Dr. Christopher Gardner is talking about here? Or are they just addicted to soybean oil and donuts and cookies and biscuits and the rest?
Well, it really would take a sea change from the consumer perspective to, if you will, wean them from the things that we eat every day and enjoy every day to that kind of a diet. It's not that it can't be done, and I think the point about the children is a really good point to make, that they're learning these habits now, and so if we can help them learn healthful habits, and by doing that, if we're imposing that on our children, by design, we're going to have to change our habits and, you know, and make a sea change. But it's not going to happen overnight. We didn't get this way overnight. So to make that shift will take some time.
So you could build a market for more healthful products, and yet the market is flooded with stuff for children that is, you know, obviously lousy for children. Jay is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, I'm a practicing cardiologist and physician as well, so I have my own little perspective here.
All right.
One of the things that has not been explored in this discussion, and in fact no research has been done at all in this area, is the addictive nature of saturated and trans fatty containing foods.
Addictive, as in addiction.
As a physical issue, the physical medical issue. There is almost no research that has been done into this. There's a reason why certain types of people keep going back and back and back towards for this kind of food. And the obesity research has been going on recently. There's recently been genes found in this area that it certainly predisposes the certain people who have a predisposition, a genetic or otherwise predisposition towards this. And so basically what I'm saying is that there could be an addictive component for which research needs to be done, and then we need to decide whether the marketing of these products is ethical given the addictive potential of these foods.
And let's say there is, then what? Methadone donuts, or what does that suggest, Jay?
Well, I think it has grave implications for public policy. I mean,
yeah.
Yale New Haven Hospital recently did some research that showed that about 30% of children had what's called latent hyperinsulinemia. They were already pre-diabetic. Well, so you can imagine the epidemic of cardiovascular disease that's already in place, that's going to come.
And turbocharged by addiction. Jay, thanks for the call. Christopher Gardner, how about it? I must say, I look at a Krispy Kreme sitting on the plate and I feel an almost addicted desire to eat that thing. What about this? Is there such a thing as an addiction to trans fats, saturated fats?
That donut's calling to you, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
I agree with the caller that there really isn't much research in that particular area, so you'd have to simply speculate at this point. But the caller has a great point in that that's what turned the smoking issue when he found out that there was something addictive and that it was being manipulated. I mean, that really got a lot of legislation behind the anti-smoking movement. If that happened with food, the same kind of thing would happen. It's not there right now. I don't know that there is a genetic component. There could be, but it would take years to establish that kind of connection.
Ross Petty, you've been listening along. Can you see in the food industry a voluntary shift in what they produce and how they market it that might be in sync, if it could ever come, with a real shift in American diets?
Well, I keep going back to the cost issue. I think there are a lot of for example, government subsidies supporting the price of corn, from which we get corn sweeteners, soy, beans, and so on, so that it's relatively difficult and more expensive to shift to alternative formulations.
So a lot of big hedges standing out there to get by. Ross Petty, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Ross Petty is professor of marketing law at Babson College's Olin Graduate School of Management. We're talking tonight about fat in the public fire, America's obsession with fat. Will America's big food makers ever produce truly healthy foods? Should they be forced to? Are you ready to buy them if they do? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about fat in the public fire, about trans fats, fat suits, fat in the label, fat in the Oreos. Americans' obsession with fat. Whose fault is fat, the producers or the consumers? And a question, and it's a real one right now, should food makers be protected by law from lawsuits from overweight Americans? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 4-2-3-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Chicago by Colleen Zammer. She's a food scientist with TIAX, a company that works with food companies on technology and food production. From Palo Alto, California, by Dr. Christopher Gardner, director of Stanford University's Center for Research in Disease Prevention. And right now, from Bridgehampton, New York, by Meredith Berkman. She's a columnist and freelance writer. She has filed a lawsuit against the maker of the snack food Pirate's Booty. That is Robert's American Gourmet Foods Incorporated. Good evening and welcome, Meredith Berkman.
Hi, good evening.
Hi. So you are taking on Pirate's Booty. Why?
Well, as a mom of three children under 3.5, I felt very strongly that a food company should not lie about their ingredients and their fats. Specifically, I would buy Pirate's Booty. I would give it to my children. And one day I idly turned the package over in the supermarket and realized that they had almost doubled the fat content from the day before when I bought it somewhere else.
Now, Meredith, I don't know what Pirate's Booty is. I read that it's what? It's rice puffs?
It's rice puffs. It's sort of like the poor man's Cheetos.
I mean,
it was a snack food that was too good to be true. It tasted like a very cheesy, salty snack. But
and the package declares, good for you.
Right. And the fact is that it is still a low-fat snack, but that they basically, they lied about the amount of fat. They said that it was because they changed the recipe and they changed the equipment, et cetera, et cetera. But in fact, this was a company that had, you can hear my kids screaming in the background, I apologize.
We want Pirate's Booty.
Booty. Well, now when we go to the store, I try to explain, we can't buy it because mommy's in litigation. I have the only 3.5-year-old who understands litigation.
You filed a $50 million class action lawsuit claiming emotional distress and nutritional damage. Jay Leno mocked you on his show. He said,
That's right.
A tip. If the snack you're eating contains the word booty, you're probably not going to be losing much weight. Are you after $50 million, or
no,
exactly what are you after,
all,
Meredith
first
Berkman?
Of all, when I filed the suit, and the lawyers, of course, used legalese, I said from the very beginning that any amount of money I would ever get goes immediately to charity. I don't want their money. What I want is a company to tell the truth. And as a parent, giving this to my child, to my children, I felt very strongly that I shouldn't be lied to. You know, the FDA has limited resources and limited time to investigate these medium size and small companies. And when I looked into it, when I, you know, as a journalist, when I investigated, I realized this is a company that had been admonished by the FDA before for making spurious claims about their food products.
Let me ask you about that then. When you want the truth out there, in the Pirate Booty case, they were apparently, allegedly misrepresenting what was in the bag. What about companies that say exactly what's in the bag and yet market it, you know, with bright colors and appealing words that suggest that you ought to eat this, even if it's not? Is that a truth that ought to be the target of lawsuits as well?
No. See, my issue is specifically, look, fat grams don't kill you, as far as I can tell. You know, I was outraged as a consumer, as a mother, as a journalist, because a company told me that their product had X number of fat grams, and it really had almost double. And I feel a responsibility. I want my kids to know that in this country, if someone tells you my product has X, it better have X.
Colleen Zammer, let me get you to respond to that. You advise a lot of food companies. I don't know if you've advised Pirate's Booty, but do you think it's legitimate to go after them with a $50 million lawsuit?
First of all, I want to make one point. That
yes.
$50 million is a number that the lawyers pick out of the air. It's a cap on a potential claim, a potential settlement for all of the consumers who bought that product. It's not about $50 million for any one person.
We've got it, and what you're trying to do there is to make a point. Colleen Zammer, yes. Is that a legitimate point? Colleen.
Yes. The company, Pirate's Booty, any of the companies, they are legally obligated to put the correct information on the label. And, you know, going back to the ethics discussion, yes, there is an ethical element to that, too. But legally, they are responsible for putting the correct information on the label. And it sounds like this is a case, and she's probably right, that they're a small company that thought they could skirt under the radar screen, and it sounds like they got their hand slapped. Now, whether they truly were going through a reformulation effort, you know, maybe the product didn't taste as good as they would have liked it to taste, and they changed the formulation and therefore changed the label. And I think you've got to research that and find out if that's true or not. But they are obligated to have the correct information on that label, and if it was truly not the right information, then yes, it makes sense to expose that.
And, of course, it's the wider threat of lawsuits that has a lot of companies' attention. Meredith Berkman, I want to thank you for joining us with your story tonight.
Thank you.
Keep that pirate's booty away from the kids. Thanks a lot for being with us. Meredith Berkman has filed a $50 million class action lawsuit against Roberts American Gourmet, producers of Pirate's Booty. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Eileen is calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Eileen. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to comment on my daughter was admitted to Children's Hospital.
In Boston. Mm-hmm.
In Boston. She has diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, which is totally different than type 2 diabetes. But
Was it related to diet or to weight, Eileen?
Not at all. Mm-hmm. But my comment was that the snacks that were offered, and having type 1 diabetes, you have to have a certain amount of snacks throughout the day.
Right.
They virtually all contain trans fatty acids.
Are you saying the snacks offered at the hospital itself?
Exactly, all of them. Goldfish, graham crackers, saltines. And, I commented kind of jokingly with the staff, and it seemed to go over everybody's head. But I'm glad you're doing your program and that this has kind of hit the news. But, my comment was that it's so pervasive. And now we read labels all the time. And it's in everything in the supermarket. I mean, you have to pick, there's very limited amount of food. And I don't know if I'm nitpicking. We eat fairly healthily. So, one of your guests had said, well, if you only have a little bit, it's not going to kill you. But it is an irony, to go to Children's Hospital and you don't have a choice of snacks without trans fat.
Yeah, I'd say so. Eileen, thanks for your call. Dr. Gardner, what about it? Here's a child with diabetes going to the hospital and being served up snacks that would fall outside the healthful category you were describing a minute ago. And her mother says, look how pervasive these things are. Even hospitals dishing them up, that suggests a very large kind of change of mind frame or attitude necessary before the country really turns around on fat.
Oh, absolutely. It is that pervasive, and it is that ironic that in a health care setting, your options are that limited. And so from a marketing or a food industry perspective, I'm not really sure how to approach that. It is everywhere, and something needs to be done, but is it really the consumers demanding that in the hospital, or is it that's what the hospital's providing, or is there some other motivation involved? I can tell you that here in California schools, where they've had not necessarily trans fatty acid issues, but soda pop contracts with schools, mm-hmm. It's amazing to see who goes in to defend the soda pop contracts. It's some of the people in the food service. It's some of the principals. It's some of the coaches saying, we use this money for sports uniforms, or I'm a nutritionist and we have no cafeteria in the school to provide food for the kids, so we have to go to outside vendors, and we don't have any other good choices, so Burger King or Taco Bell was the best choice we could come up with, and we're using the profits for those sports uniforms. So there's an amazing number of twists to the story of what's motivating what those food choices are. It's not just consumer demand. It's a lot more complicated than that, and I don't pretend to understand it all.
And meanwhile, the country gets fatter and fatter and fatter. The numbers on obesity just continue to rise. Now there's legislation that's been proposed in the Congress that would block consumers from bringing tobacco-style suits against food manufacturers on the basis that they encouraged ill health. Whereas that might have seemed to be one big crowbar, as crazy it can sound sometimes, at least it might be a way to break the cycle, to get the food manufacturer's attention. Let's turn to our callers. They've got the best perspective on this tonight, perhaps. Maurice is calling from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Maurice. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks.
I guess with respect to laying blame, I've got to say that, the young lady that called in about the lawsuit, I think, if she'd cooked the meals for her kids, it might be a little bit different. I think in other countries, more people are apt to cook meals and go out and get processed foods. And I think that our society as a whole needs to look at our collective health and make a change. It's like if we keep eating it, they'll keep making it, like you said.
But how many families barely have time to get a pot on the stove, Maurice? There's been a booming market in ready-to-eat foods, and the kind of time demands that produce that demand. We may have lost Maurice there, but Colleen Zammer, lots of food manufacturers have responded to time famine with ready-to-eat stuff.
That's absolutely right. I mean, convenience is a major driver in the products that are available on the market today. And that's why you see so many processed, prepackaged foods that are ready to consume. And I think that's one reason why the hospitals and schools and such are going that route. You know, you've got vending machines and such to serve your consumers, constituents, because without those kinds of processed foods, the shelf life of traditional foods or raw foods is very short. It's going to cost an awful lot of money to maintain those kinds of foods. So prepackaged foods are the most convenient way to go from the consumer perspective and the provider perspective, which is that's why they're so pervasive.
Barbara's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had two points I wanted to make.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, first, I wanted to emphasize the fact that people, I live in Jamaica Plain, so and I have a lot of availability for great health food stores and whatnot, but when I go to, say, a Stop and Shop or whatnot, I go online and I see a lot of people in my neighborhood are buying food for just 2 or 3 days because that's all that they can afford because they're going for just a couple of, they work so many hours in a week that they need to get these quick, packed, pre-made meals and whatnot for their
family.
Right,
it's a fact of life for many people.
Exactly, mm-hmm. And they just need to make sure that their families have something that they can prepare quickly. And,
yeah, and your second point?
And my second point was I thought that maybe, I think that the tobacco lawsuits have a little bit more validity than these fat foods lawsuits because there are many more things affecting fat in our bodies than just the fat contents of our foods. I think that there's a lot of things in American society that are
exercise and couch potato habits.
Exactly. Longer commutes and watching too much television and video games and all of those things affect us. And I don't know if it's so easy to point your finger at McDonald's and say, you're the reason why Americans are fat.
Absolutely. No, we hear you. And yet, at some point, the country's got this huge health problem that needs to be turned around, and it's going to require, it would seem to me, everybody playing some part in that for that to happen. But Barbara, thank you for calling. Let's get one more call. Stella's calling from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Stella. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for this program.
Sure.
My question is, Colleen Zellmer?
Yes, Zellmer.
Zellmer, thank you. Put the responsibility for on the consumer to communicate to the manufacturers that we want to have healthier products.
Okay, right.
I have no idea how to do that. Will she please educate us on how to do that? I would love to do it. I have no idea how to do it. So
let's get it in a nutshell, Stella. Stella, we've got it. That's great. Colleen Zemmer, if consumers want to let their desire for different foods be known to manufacturers, what's the best way to do it?
Every packaged food has a consumer hotline on it. That number you can call, you can give them any kind of comment, question, concern that you have regarding the food product.
Okay, there's one.
And if enough people call those numbers and make the point known saying, you know, we don't want trans fats or we want smaller portions or we want healthier options, then the food companies are going to start to take notice.
But ultimately it's buying patterns, I suppose.
Right, and a buying pattern, or in this case maybe a negative buying pattern, that you stop buying Oreos and you stop buying Doritos, and as those sales fall off, they're going to start to wonder why, and they'll start asking the consumers. They'll do more focus groups. They'll analyze the numbers, and if they determine that, okay, people are not buying these things anymore because they don't want them anymore. They want something different. What do they want? We'll make what they want.
So find something else to buy, and that's a pretty loud message. Dr. Gardner, we've just got a half a minute left here, but if you wanted to point out several things that are very common in American diets that consumers ought to steer clear of, given everything that's come out in the last in headlines recently, what kind of foods, very specifically, would you say to avoid?
Well, it's those same snack foods that the trans fats are in, whether you take them out or leave them in. That's really what's been giving us a problem, is the snack foods that are available everywhere. I'd much prefer people to go get these mixed greens that are now available. They're pre-washed. They've got mixed and cut veggies for you. They're making those more and more convenient. There's all kinds of soy products that are out there, and people are buying them. So some people are putting their money where their health interests are, and we are seeing new products come out, and they're still there a couple years later, and I'm really excited about some of those transitions.
So look for something that's got a vegetable in it, something that's green. Christopher Gardner, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Dr. Christopher Gardner is director of Stanford University's Center for Research in Disease Prevention. And Colleen Zemmer, it's been great having you. Thanks for joining us from Chicago.
Thank you very much.
Colleen Zemmer is with TX, a firm that advises food companies on technology and food production. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.